Chapter 7. Where have all the war crimes gone? Throughout the early years of the Vietnam War, civilian suffering was everywhere and yet nowhere in the American media. News reports described thousands of incidents that violated the laws of war, but usually skipped blithely past the implications, neither labeling nor acknowledging the crimes. And for every war crime that was mentioned in a newspaper or magazine, a mass of other evidence was covered up in the field or kept secret at higher command levels. The secrecy went all the way up to the Pentagon. In 1967, for instance, after some newspaper reports about atrocities committed in Vietnam by members of the Special Forces, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara commissioned an inquiry to find out how well U.S. troops understood the Geneva Conventions. A team of agents headed by W. Donald Stewart, the chief of the Pentagon's Investigations Division for the Directorate of Inspection Services, compiled a 208-page report with shocking implications. More than 96% of the Marine Corps second lieutenants they surveyed, for example, indicated that they would resort to torture to obtain information. "I came back from South Vietnam thinking that things were out of control," Stewart recalled years later, but he knew that his findings wouldn't have been good for the political image of the military or the president, and the Pentagon certainly agreed. A high-ranking Defense Department official ordered the report to be placed in review status, a form of bureaucratic limbo meant to kill it. Its findings were never made public. As time went on, though, some cover-ups began to crumble. In August 1969, after their elaborate scheme unraveled, seven members of the Special Forces were implicated in the torture and killing of the intelligence operative Thai Cock Quyen. Whispers circulated about CIA involvement in the case, and the Green Beret affair made the covers of Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News & World Report. Soon, articles began to probe the Phoenix program, the agency's role in targeted killings, and, as the celebrated Washington Post reporter Ward Just put it, other dirty business Americans have undertaken in this war. This flurry of revelations would be short-lived, however. Within a few weeks, under pressure from the CIA and the White House, Secretary of the Army Stanley Reeser dismissed all charges against the Green Berets, foreclosing any possibility that further sordid details, including a dossier of CIA and Special Forces assassinations put together by the defendants, might be entered into evidence in a courtroom. August 1969 saw the publication of Norman Poirier's chilling Esquire article, An American Atrocity, which used military legal documents to reconstruct the 1966 rampage of U.S. Marines through the hamlet of Xuân Ngoc, including the gang rape of 18-year-old Bui Thi Huong and the slaughter of her family. The magazine sent proofs of the story to every major newspaper in the country, hoping to generate attention, but none showed the slightest interest. A few months later, in October 1969, The New Yorker published Daniel Lang's harrowing account of the 1966 kidnapping, gang rape, and murder of Phan Thi Mao by an army patrol in Tu Cor. Lang's Casualties of War, later adapted into a motion picture of the same name, not only revealed horrific crimes, but also detailed the tremendous struggle of a lone whistleblower, Sven Eriksson, against a concerted cover-up by the four perpetrators and their superior officers. Eriksson survived a possible attempt on his life by one of the patrol members and steadfastly testified at multiple courts-martial as the proceedings stretched out over several years. He told Lang his story after becoming frustrated with the Army's legalistic nitpicking and the light sentences ultimately given to the guilty men. Eriksson's account made it clear that such atrocities in Vietnam were commonplace. As Lang wrote, "Eriksson told me that it seemed clear to him in retrospect that he should have been prepared for Mao's death. It had been preceded by any number of similar occurrences. In one form or another, he said, they took place almost daily, but he was slow or reluctant to perceive that they were as much a part of the war as shells and targets were." The same month that Casualties of War was published, Arizona Congressman Morris Udall sent Secretary of the Army Reeser a statement written by a GI from the Lone Brigade of the 9th Infantry Division still remaining in Vietnam. "The affidavit is so specific and sincere that I feel it demands an investigation," the Arizona Democrat said in a cover note. In his statement, the soldier described the capture, torture, and cold-blooded murder of a Vietnamese man, an increasingly familiar story by late 1969. This particular account was, however, unique in one way. It came from a dead man. On September 12, 1969, 21-year-old George Chunko had sent to his parents what he called an actual account of an incident which occurred during a combat operation of which I personally witnessed. Just days before, while on a sweep and destroy patrol, his unit had come upon a Vietnamese home. Inside it, Chunko wrote, they found a young Vietnamese woman, four young children, an elderly man, and a military-age male, later identified as Do Van Man. From the identification papers on the individuals, it appeared that Man may have been AWOL from the South Vietnamese Army, and that the others present were his wife, his children, and his father-in-law. Led by Lieutenant James Duffy, the unit was still under extreme pressure to produce a high body count, just as it had been in Ewell's days. The leader of the platoon, Chunko wrote, fully aware of the young man's identity, seemingly ignored the knowledge, and proceeded to personally interrogate our prisoner. In full view of his family, Man was stripped naked, manhandled, and searched for physical signs that he was a member of the Revolutionary Forces. The platoon leader found none, much to his dismay, added Chunko, but nevertheless proceeded to mistreat this individual as a captured enemy soldier. Man was then taken outside and tied to a tree as his wife fell to her knees crying and begging for mercy. It was obvious that our platoon leader took some sort of malicious pleasure in humiliating her husband in her presence. In fact, it appeared that her crying prodded him further in dehumanizing her husband. He conveyed to her that he would have her husband killed in the following morning. Later, Chunko watched as the prisoner was ridiculed, slapped around, and had mud rubbed into his face. When he asked his fellow unit members why they were torturing a man that no one believed was an actual VC, they said they were just having a little fun. Repulsed, Chunko left the scene and began complaining about it to another soldier, but a platoon sergeant stepped in to shut him up. Before the unit moved out the next morning, Chunko wrote, the prisoner was taken into the nearby woodline by a few of us GIs. I distinctly heard seven shots go off and saw the aforementioned GIs return from the woodline sans prisoner. The platoon leader, self-appointed judge, jury, and executioner, had his breakfast content that he was doing a good job. Man was called in as an enemy prisoner killed while trying to escape. Only one day after Chunko wrote and signed his statement and mailed it off to his parents, he was killed as well. According to a confidential Army communique, he was hit by frags during a nighttime ambush patrol. Chunko's parents, suspecting that their son had been murdered to cover up the crime, then forwarded his statement to Congressman Udall. In late November 1969, the Army wrote back to Udall, informing him that it was investigating the killing of Do Van Man. Lieutenant Duffy was court-martialed and the following year found guilty of premeditated murder, only to have the jury retract that verdict when they found out that it carried a mandatory life sentence. Instead, the military court decided that the killing of Do Van Man would cost Duffy just 6 months in prison, with less than half his pay forfeited during that time. He wouldn't even have to leave the Army. Military lawyers who observed the proceedings noted that the outcome appeared to be yet another example of the mere gook rule. Indeed, the only reason why Duffy wasn't acquitted altogether, some of them speculated, was that the Army could no longer count on keeping the story entirely under wraps. By the time of Duffy's trial, thanks to Ron Reidenauer and his persistent efforts to bring attention to the My Lai massacre, war crimes were finally front-page news. Reidenauer had initially collected information about the 1968 massacre from various eyewitnesses while he was still serving in Vietnam. In April 1969, not long after returning to the United States, he sent registered letters to more than 30 military and civilian leaders in Washington, telling them that something rather dark and bloody had happened in the village. Reidenauer's letter, filled with names, locations, and descriptions of the mass killing, soon had Washington buzzing. Looking for a suitably low-level fall guy on whom to hang responsibility, the Army settled on Lieutenant William Rusty Calley, who had commanded Charlie Company's 1st Platoon at My Lai and had no shortage of blood on his hands. Conveniently enough, Calley was no West Pointer, but a product of the Officer Candidate School at Fort Benning, which turned out low-level commanders for Vietnam after just months of training. Placing the blame entirely on him would avoid sullying the reputation of the Army's academy-trained top ranks, thus protecting the public image of the Army as a whole. In September, Kali was charged with the murder of 109 Oriental human beings and quietly hidden away at Fort Benning. Trying to bring the massacre to wider attention, though, Ridenour found the media still largely uninterested in exposing the truth about American activities in Vietnam. He shared his information with a reporter for the Arizona Republic, but an editor there refused to run the piece, which would have been the first article on My Lai to appear in the United States. Through a literary agent, Ridenour then offered his story to Life, Look, Newsweek, and Harper's. All of them passed. Only Rampart showed interest, but Ridenour was wary of the story being written off if it were published in a radical journal of the New Left. Like so many other atrocity accounts, the events at My Lai might have faded into oblivion. In the fall of 1969, though, the freelance journalist Seymour Hersh received a vague tip about an officer who had killed some 70 or 80 people. Hersh managed to find and interview Kali at Fort Benning, laying the foundation for a series of articles that would eventually win him a Pulitzer Prize. Despite the stunning quality of his reporting, Life and Look once again passed on the story. Finding that newspapers were likewise uninterested, Hersh turned to Dispatch News Service, a little-known left-leaning news agency, which finally got his story into the mainstream. On November 13th, Hersh's article ran in 35 newspapers, including the Chicago Sun-Times, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Milwaukee Journal. Within a couple of weeks, the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Life had both published grisly photographs of the massacre taken by Ron Haberle, including a heap of civilian bodies with children clearly among them. Adding fuel to the fire, Charlie Company's Paul Meadlow appeared in the CBS television interview with Mike Wallace, confessing his crimes. He admitted that the troops had rounded up and shot hundreds of men, women, and children. "And babies?" Wallace asked repeatedly. "And babies," Meadlow replied. After many months of sitting on evidence of the My Lai slaughter, the Army was visibly reeling. On November 21, 1969, Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird spoke privately to President Nixon's National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger about how, although he realized he couldn't, he'd like to sweep the whole thing under the rug. That same day, at Laird's urging, the White House Communications Director Herbert Klein warned Nixon's Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman that the My Lai case could develop into a major trial almost of the Nuremberg scope and could have a major effect on public opinion. The Pentagon knew that it needed to contain the damage. Within days, Westmoreland and Resor appointed Lieutenant General William Pierce, a non-West Pointer who had commanded the 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam, to head an army inquiry into My Lai. The work was meant to give the appearance that the military was taking decisive action. Few people realized, though, that Pierce's much-publicized inquiry was only supposed to explore the Army's inadequate early investigations of the massacre at My Lai and the subsequent cover-up of the incident, not the killings themselves. The instructions from Westmoreland and Resor explicitly told Pierce that the scope of your investigation does not include ongoing criminal investigations in progress. Pierce, however, went beyond this limited mandate, and his panel's final report was far more frank than the Army wished. As background to its investigation of the cover-up, the panel forthrightly stated that American soldiers had engaged in widespread killing of Vietnamese inhabitants in the area, and that these inhabitants were comprised almost exclusively of old men, women, and children. The language of the inquiry's report left little doubt about what had occurred. It concluded that the crimes visited on the inhabitants included individual and group acts of murder, rape, sodomy, maiming, and assault on non-combatants, spoke of a massacre and an almost total disregard for the lives and property of the civilian population, and concluded that the number of Vietnamese killed may exceed 400. Moving on to the massacre's cover-up, the report then detailed a pattern of deliberate suppression or withholding of information at every command level from company to division. Pierce's panel particularly blamed Colonel Orrin Henderson, the commander of the 11th Infantry Brigade, both for failing to stop the slaughter and for filing false reports about it afterward. Although Henderson had been hovering over the area in a command-and-control helicopter during the assault on My Lai and also heard about the massacre in detail from several aviation unit personnel, he reported to his superiors that only about 20 civilians had died in the village, and that these had been accidentally killed by preparatory artillery or by crossfire between Americans and the Vietnamese Revolutionary Forces. Henderson's superiors, the Peers report noted, then acted to conceal even those supposedly limited civilian deaths from higher headquarters. When local Vietnamese accounts of the horrific massacre reached U.S. advisors in the area, Henderson was also instrumental in getting the Army to disregard them as baseless propaganda. When Westmoreland and Reeser saw a preliminary version of the report, the Secretary of the Army immediately summoned Peers. He didn't want to control the report, he stressed, but the message was clear: tone things down. At the press conference announcing the results of the inquiry, the Pentagon wouldn't even allow Peers to refer to the My Lai incident as a massacre. The version of the report released to the press in March 1970 was so heavily censored that it contained virtually no information about the massacre that hadn't already appeared in newspapers. The actual findings of the Peers investigation were bottled up and kept secret for over 4 years, getting released only in late 1974, after the end of Richard Nixon's presidency. The Pentagon was especially dismayed that Peers had chronicled not only the slaughter at My Lai by Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry, but also the killings carried out on the same day in the nearby village of My Khe by the men of Bravo Company, 4th Battalion, 3rd Infantry. The whole Pentagon strategy centered on portraying My Lai as a one-off aberration, rather than part of a consistent pattern of criminality resulting from policies set at the top. Having two different massacres carried out within hours of each other by two entirely different army units in two separate villages was hardly compatible with that message. So when reporters asked about the events at My Khe, Peers sidestepped the questions, and Pentagon briefers simply lied, saying that the massacre had been perpetrated by South Vietnamese troops. Westmoreland covered his ass, Colonel Henry Tufts, the head of Army Criminal Investigative Command, would observe years later about the Chief of Staff's response to the My Lai affair. He did what he had to do to sort of preserve the system. The heat generated by the coverage of the massacre got Nixon asking questions about other potential My Lais on the horizon. By the beginning of 1970, Westmoreland had assembled an unofficial task force from members of his staff to monitor allegations of war crimes and serve as an early warning system for the Pentagon and the President. Over the next few years, the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group continuously kept an eye on the Army's atrocity investigations and provided regular reports to the military brass and the White House. The group did not work to bring accused war criminals to justice or to prevent war crimes from occurring in the first place, nor did it make public the constant stream of allegations flowing in from soldiers and veterans. As far as the War Crimes Working Group was concerned, these allegations were purely an image management problem, to be parried or buried as quickly as possible. Over time, the group became a key part of the Pentagon system for hiding the true nature of the war from the American public. The brass had good reason to be worried. As the 1970s began, the Pentagon's blanket denials about atrocities in Vietnam were definitely showing signs of fatigue. Seymour Hersh's My Lai expose had changed things. Even if most atrocities were still buried with the bodies in rural hamlets that few Americans had ever heard of, more and more stories were finding their way to a reporter, past a Saigon bureau chief, over the wire to New York, and then into a newspaper or magazine. A decade into the war, and 6 years after Lyndon Johnson had flooded the country with combat troops, enough evidence had emerged to leave increasing numbers of Americans asking questions. What was really happening in Southeast Asia? What did it mean when reports described different units in different parts of the country at different times doing the same horrible things? Could there really be that many bad apples with the same inclinations? Or was something more sinister at work? Could America, the world's good guys, have implemented a system of destruction that turned rural zones into killing fields and made war crimes all but inevitable? Indeed, for a brief moment in 1971, it looked as if the floodgates were about to burst. The coverage of atrocities was no longer confined to brief news articles without context. For years, the public had been seeing photos of dead and injured Vietnamese children in Life and other magazines, while the nightly news showed Vietnamese homes being consumed by flames. Jonathan Schell's powerful inquiry into the utter devastation of Quang Ngai province had come out in book form, as had Daniel Lang's account of the kidnapping, rape, and murder of Phan Thi Mao and Seymour Hersh's still incomparable account of the massacre at My Lai. Dozens of other books, such as the devastating volumes In the Name of America and War Crimes and the American Conscience, ate away at the notion that each atrocity brought to the attention of the American public was a singular incident. Denying the real American way of war in Vietnam, once a simple task for the U.S. military, was turning into a desperate scramble. Not long before, any mention of American criminality or the widespread nature of atrocities in Vietnam had been easily dismissed as leftist kookery or communist propaganda. But by 1971, years of revelations had opened a space for discussion. What had once been accepted only in anti-war circles was increasingly found credible in the mainstream. In 1970, Edward Herman's meaty little volume, Atrocities in Vietnam, had been published by Tiny Pilgrim Press. But in 1971, it was the publishing giant Random House that put out Crimes of War by Richard Falk, Gabriel Coco, and Robert J. Lifton. Even if many Americans were still resistant, newspaper editors still wary, and television news executives eternally skittish, the accumulating evidence of a nightmare war in Vietnam was growing more difficult to ignore. By early 1971, Telford Taylor, a retired Army general who had served as chief counsel for the prosecution at the Nuremberg trials, was speaking out on ABC Television's Dick Cavett Show and sparring in the pages of the New York Times with Secretary of the Army Stanley Raeser and Army General Counsel Robert Jordan about the potential guilt of General Westmoreland himself. Raeser and Jordan admitted that, in connection with My Lai, they had given thought to the Yamashita precedent, the case of a Japanese general who had been found guilty by an American military tribunal and executed in 1946 for failing to prevent atrocities by his troops, even though he had lost communication with the soldiers and had no direct control over them. Under the Yamashita standard, Taylor argued, war crimes committed by Americans in Vietnam, the widespread bombing and shelling of civilian hamlets in free-fire zones, the forced evacuations of peasants from their homes, and general failure to provide for the safety and care of civilians could leave American commanders like Westmoreland in the dock. Apparently rattled, Westmoreland established a task force to examine the conduct of the war in Vietnam, Cowan, and provide an insurance policy against Taylor and other critics. The group spent more than 5,000 man-hours putting together its whitewash of a report, which predictably concluded that war crimes allegations against the U.S. commander were unfounded. While isolated criminal acts may have occurred during General Westmoreland's tenure in Vietnam, the report insisted, they were neither widespread nor extensive enough to render him criminally responsible for their commission. In a brazen rewriting of history, the Cowan Report attempted to distance Westmoreland from those policies most associated with his tenure in Vietnam, search-and-destroy operations, free-fire zones, and the application of massive firepower. Instead, the report asserted that General Westmoreland demanded strict adherence to the laws of war and claimed that the rules of engagement he had put in place established an elaborate system of checks and clearances with local officials to ensure the safety of civilians throughout the country. The Cowan Report even took specific aim at Jonathan Schell's coverage of the war, without ever mentioning the secret official inquiry, approved by Westmoreland himself, that had validated Schell's most crucial findings. Ultimately, the Cowan Report wasn't made public, but its very existence testifies to the dramatically altered atmosphere in the country. It had been one thing for anti-war radicals to call the former top commander in Vietnam and now the Army's chief of staff a war criminal, quite another for a retired American general who had prosecuted the top Nazis to say much the same. And Westmoreland was keenly aware of the hundreds of other atrocity allegations sitting in his office, as yet unknown to the public, many prematurely closed and buried with his help. Westmoreland was feeling the heat. He was also watching his beloved Army crumble around him. It may seem hard to believe now, but in 1971, the American military as an institution seemed to be on the verge of collapse. When Colonel Robert Heinel, a distinguished combat veteran as well as a military historian and analyst, examined its state in Armed Forces Journal, his evaluation was dire. The morale, discipline, and battleworthiness of the U.S. Armed Forces are, with few salient exceptions, lower and worse than at any time in this century and possibly in the history of the United States. By every conceivable indicator, our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers, drug-ridden and dispirited where not near mutinous. The state of revolt in the armed forces, Heinl concluded, was just shy of the French army's Nivelle mutinies of 1917 and the collapse of the Tsarist armies in 1916 and 1917. A worse description was hardly possible. The extreme levels of discontent meant that civilians and long-retired officers like Telford Taylor were not the only ones criticizing the Army's conduct. Active-duty soldiers and recently returned veterans were also speaking up against the military. By 1971, anti-war GIs were producing hundreds of underground newspapers that encouraged disobedience and rebellion. In his article, Heinl counted no fewer than 14 GI dissent organizations, including two made up exclusively of officers, that were operating more or less openly, plus at least six anti-war veterans groups which strive to influence GIs. That April, in an unprecedented act, highly decorated veterans descended on Washington to return their medals and ribbons, honors that previous generations of American fighting men had always treasured. Gloria Emerson, who had covered the war as a correspondent for the New York Times, described the emotional scene. They started to come on a Friday, an eccentric, a strange-looking army, wearing fatigues and field jackets, helmets, and their old boonie hats, the same boots they had worn in Vietnam. Some brought bedrolls, and all slept outdoors on a camping site on a small quadrangle on the Mall. All came with their discharge papers so their bitterest critics could not accuse them of being imposters, although some did anyway. There were a few men who did not have two legs, a few who could not rise from wheelchairs, but they were in good spirits and among their own. When the authorities erected a barricade to stop the protesters from reaching Congress, they simply reared back and hurled their Purple Hearts and Bronze Stars over the wooden wire wall onto the steps of the Capitol, in perhaps the single most iconic anti-war act in American history. A few dozen tried to get someone to arrest them as war criminals, but no one would. However, when 110 of the veterans sat down on the steps of the Supreme Court to protest its failure to rule on the constitutionality of the war, the police moved in. Without resistance, the men placed their hands on their heads, as prisoners were made to do in Vietnam, and were taken away. Young veterans were also coming forward by the hundreds to offer unambiguous testimony about the omnipresent atrocities in Vietnam, drawing crowds at public talks, anti-war rallies, and war crimes forums. They were doing what no American fighting men had done for 200 years, speaking out en masse against their own military. Describing the crimes committed in Vietnam in the name of America, they were, in effect, testifying against themselves. Their haunting accounts of assaults and rapes, torture and murder, detailed not only what they had seen, but in many cases what they'd been ordered to do. There was a lieutenant standing behind screaming at me to break the man, break being the military intelligence term to get the information, former Army interrogator Peter Martinson told an assembled crowd in Washington. And he was screaming to break him, and so I pushed the prisoner over backward, and I almost broke his neck. I finished that interrogation, and I walked across our compound to another tent where interrogation was going on, a man of draftable age, no ID card. We were quite convinced he was a VC, and I proceeded to beat him with my fists. And you can beat a man senseless with your fists and not leave marks except for a slight reddening of the skin, perhaps. And this went on for some time. A lieutenant came in, and he proceeded to beat the man to no effect. And then he wired electrical field phone wires around the man's left wrist and proceeded to ring him up, as the term goes. Now this didn't work. The lieutenant pulled down the man's trousers and proceeded to touch the electrical wires to the man's genitals and cranking the field telephone at the same time, giving him very painful shocks. All he got was a lot of I don't knows and some very violent screams. Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the largest and most significant of the anti-war veterans groups, boasted 10,000 members by the early 1970s, as ever more veterans felt the need to counter the official lies that they heard when they returned home. Many had gone to Vietnam with their heads filled with visions by their father's war, as seen through the prism of the John Wayne movies of their childhoods. The war they would fight, however, proved to be nothing like it had been on the silver screen. To drive home the realities of war to ordinary Americans, some VVAW members stalked through small towns on mock search and destroy missions, wearing their old fatigues and carrying toy M16 rifles. Sometimes they handed out a flyer. A U.S. infantry company just came through here. If you had been Vietnamese, we might have burned your house. We might have shot your dog. We might have shot you. We might have raped your wife and daughter. We might have turned you over to your government for torture. We might have taken souvenirs from your property. We might have shot things up a bit. We might have done all these things to you and your whole town. If it doesn't bother you that American soldiers do these things every day to the Vietnamese simply because they are gooks, then picture yourself as one of the silent victims. The VVAW membership ranks included Jamie Henry, the medic who had witnessed members of Company B, 1st Battalion, 35th Infantry, massacre a group of women and children in February 1968 during the Tet counteroffensive. Immediately after the massacre, Henry had made a vow to himself that he would expose the true nature of the war, but this proved to be an uphill battle. In Vietnam, when he'd spoken up about brutality, friends had warned him that if he said anything of the sort again, he might get a bullet in the back during a firefight. After his return to the United States, Henry had gone right to the judge advocate's office at Fort Hood, Texas, but the Army lawyer there also gave him a chilly reception. "The attorney for the Army told me that I should hold off on it until I was out of the service, because there are various ways of making people be quiet in the Army or doing things to make them disappear," Henry later recalled. Even the radical magazine Ramparts had thought Henry's account too hot to handle. In late 1968, the magazine's military editor met with Henry and wrote up his story, but the article, which would have been the first American eyewitness account of a My Lai-style massacre to appear in print, was shelved. Only in the spring of 1970 did Henry's story finally make it into print, running in the debut issue of the short-lived muckraking magazine Scanlon's Monthly. At a press conference, he told reporters that incidents similar to those I have described occur on a daily basis and differ one from the other only in terms of numbers killed. The next day, a brief article about these remarks appeared in the Los Angeles Times, and Army investigators finally met with Henry for an interview. But although they took a 10-page sworn statement from him, by this point Henry had little faith in military justice. "I never got the impression they were ever doing anything," he told me years later. Still, Henry did not give up. In January 1971, he joined more than 100 other Vietnam veterans who testified in Detroit for a VVAW-organized event that they called the Winter Soldier Investigation. The name was taken from a pamphlet written by the revolutionary patriot Thomas Paine in 1776, which began, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." Once again, Henry took the audience through his experience in chilling detail. "We moved into a small hamlet. 19 women and children were rounded up as Viet Cong suspects, VCS, and the lieutenant that rounded them up called the captain on the radio, and he asked what should be done with them. The captain simply repeated the order that came down from the colonel that morning. The order that came down from the colonel that morning was to kill anything that moves. As I was walking over to him, I turned and looked in the area. I looked toward where the VCS were, supposed VCS, and two men were leading a young girl, approximately 19 years old, very pretty, out of a hooch. She had no clothes on, so I assumed she had been raped, which was pretty SOP, and that's standard operating procedure for civilians, and she was thrown onto the pile of the 19 women and children, and five men around the circle opened up on full automatic with their M16s, and that was the end of that." The Winter Soldier investigation included testimonies from every branch of the U.S. military and almost every major combat unit from all periods of the war. By their very act of testifying, these veterans put the lie to any notion of bad apples and isolated incidents, and many went beyond merely rattling off a list of individual atrocities. Instead, broadening their focus, the Winter Soldiers explicitly pointed to superior officers and command policies as the ultimate sources of the war crimes they had seen or committed. After describing several other killings of non-combatants that he had witnessed, Henry told the audience, "I don't want to go into the details of these executions, because the executions are the direct result of a policy. It's the policy that is important. The executions are secondary because the executions are created by the policy, that is, I believe, a conscious policy within the military." As the year went on, the emphasis on command policies became more and more a part of the public discourse. In March, the New York Times Book Review splashed across its front page a seminal essay by Neil Sheehan, an Army veteran who had spent 3 years as a combat correspondent in Southeast Asia. The essay's title alone was explosive. "Should we have war crimes trials?" Sheehan's answer was an unqualified yes. After cataloging 33 books detailing various aspects of the U.S. way of war in Southeast Asia, Sheehan wrote, "If you credit as factual only a fraction of the information assembled here about what happened in Vietnam, and if you apply the laws of war to American conduct there, then the leaders of the United States, for the past 6 years at least, may well be guilty of war crimes." For the Army's high command, Sheehan's essay represented everything they feared. In a report put together shortly after the piece was published, one of the cadre of officers working out of Westmoreland's office fretted about the effort to propel the war crimes issue to the forefront of national attention and political debate. Sheehan's essay also inspired Daniel Ellsberg to leak to him Defense Secretary Robert McNamara's secret study of U.S. policy in Vietnam from the 1940s to 1968, which would soon become famous as the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg, who had helped write the papers, no longer worked for the State Department, but he retained a high security clearance as a RAND Corporation employee and used it to copy the classified documents. Outraged by the government's cover-up of the Green Beret affair, Ellsberg wanted, he later wrote, to expose a system that lies automatically at every level from bottom to top, from sergeant to commander-in-chief, to conceal murder.